Okay, we're looking at the Revelation chapter 6 and 7 this morning, and small group notes are down there for those who need it. We're going to fly through these. Thanks, Hugh, for reading out Revelation 6, and surely after listening to that or reading that, we must conclude that that's a description of the end of the world, isn't it? It sounds like it, doesn't it? But interestingly, in chapter, you think, well, why doesn't it finish at Revelation 6 or 7? We've got several other chapters to come. And in Revelation 8, we read of more judgments and more calamities, more things happening. And in chapter 16, the same. And it's important that we understand that when Revelation is written, it's not written in a chronological order, as it were, so that all the events that are spoken about don't necessarily follow on one from the other. What we have is three different accounts of life, as it will be after the ascension of Jesus into heaven until the day he comes back again, the second coming. And there's these three kind of different accounts speaking about the same time. Just in the same way as we've got four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and they're all written by four different authors, but they're all about Jesus and all about the same time. They're written from slightly different angles. And in the same way, we have these accounts repeating themselves, basically. But chapter 6 can certainly be described as an overview of world history. So we've seen, we've been shown what's already happened, what is happening at this very moment in time, and what will happen in the future. And it kind of parallels with what Jesus taught his disciples in Matthew chapter 24 and Mark chapter 13. If you want to quickly go to Mark chapter 13, the account when Jesus is walking with his disciples and they're going past the temple, and the disciples are really impressed with the temple buildings, and they're commenting on this. And Jesus, they're saying, what magnificent buildings. And Jesus says, not one stone will be left on another. Everyone will be thrown down. And he knows what's coming. But later he talks about, in verse 5, he says, watch out that no one deceives you. Many will come in my name, claiming I am he, and he will deceive many. Verse 7, when you hear wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still not come. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places, famines. These are the beginning of the birth pains. And he talks about persecution in the synagogues. He says brother will betray brother, etc., etc. And there's all kinds of things. The sun will be darkened. The moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from the sky. And at the time, the Son of Man will be seen coming in the clouds. And it's the same in Matthew chapter 24. And what we see in those three things, Revelation 6, Matthew 24, and Mark 13, is reference to these things, wars, international strife, famine, earthquakes, death, the gospel being preached, persecution, eclipses and shaken heavens, divine judgment, and different forces, all these different forces that shape history. And all those things are taking place and have taken place, are taking place, and will take place. It's interesting to see that Jesus says the gospel is going to be preached throughout the nations and people are going to be saved and the church is going to grow. But at exactly the same time, in the midst of all these things, in the midst of these exciting things and these good, godly things that are going to happen, there's going to be wars, there's going to be famines, there's going to be natural disasters, there's going to be persecution growing up alongside it, right at the very same time. My closest kind of experience of that was the very first time I went to Burundi in Central Africa. Burundi in 1995. Burundi is next door to Rwanda, and at one time was the same country as Rwanda, and they suffer the same issues with the tribes there, the Hutus and the Tutsis. And in 94, there was the genocide in Rwanda. And there was a smaller kind of genocide going on in Burundi at the same time. And we were invited to go out there. And people thought we were crazy because it was literally right in the height of this trouble. But weeks before we were invited, I had this dream. And I had this dream of walking with one of the pastors of Red Hill Baptist Church, and we were walking in a country I didn't recognize. And I was thinking, you know, this is not the UK, but I'm somewhere international, but I don't know where I am. Then all of a sudden, a third man, a guy called David Nderahutse, came alongside, and I immediately knew that I was in Burundi. And then I woke up, and it was very vivid. A few weeks later, we got this invitation to go to Burundi. And we had this kind of sense of peace that God was in this, that we didn't need to be afraid, that actually God was opening a door. When everybody was coming out, when the British consulate had called all their people back and they'd evacuated them, we were going into this situation and we were going there to do mission. And it was amazing because when we got there, there was a curfew on, so you weren't allowed out on the streets after 6 o'clock at night. And you weren't allowed, there were no marketplaces. Many of the shops were shut where people would gather. But the one thing they did allow was these missions to take place under kind of security. So you could hear the gunfire, you could hear the bombs going off, the grenades and all that sort of stuff. And one night it was particularly bad, and the guys we were staying with said, look, don't worry, tomorrow night I've invited the coroner to come and to tell us what's happening. And I thought that was a bit weird. Why would the coroner want to come and tell us what's happening? That didn't give me much encouragement. A coroner, I thought, is someone who pronounces someone who's dead, isn't it? And does, you know, all their bits. And so I wasn't too excited about this, but the guy got his English words mixed up and he meant colonel from the army. So when the colonel turned up the next day, he explained to us that we were okay and that he had all his men all around the city and it was going to be okay. So that kind of gave us a bit of peace. But alongside all this genocide that was going on, in the church we saw thousands of people come to faith in the space of just 2 weeks. It was remarkable. It was the first time I'd ever preached publicly, apart from youth services and things like that, at the church. And it was to like 2,000 people. It was incredible. And we baptized hundreds of people. It was like, it's kind of like, it was amazing. And what it reminded me of was the parable of the wheat and the tares growing up together. That while the gospel was being preached and people are being saved and the church is growing rapidly, at the same time there's wars and there's disasters and there's persecution happening. And that's exactly what's been happening and what is happening now and what will happen in the future. The interesting thing is what we read about chapter 6 is this, that is the Lamb who is worthy. It's Jesus, the one who opens the seals. He's the one who calls or sends out the riders. Which means that both the positive and the negative aspects of history do not happen apart from God, but under his permission. And it kind of begs the question, why is it that God allows so much suffering in his world? If it's the Lamb who opens the seals and these horses come out as a consequence to that, so he is in control. So why does he allow so much pain and suffering to happen in his world? It's the number one question and it's the number one argument against the Christian faith, isn't it? Whenever you meet with people, whether it's Alpha courses or whether it's just with friends in the pub or discussions you have, the biggest complaint that people have is if God is so good and he is so loving and he is so almighty, then why does he allow suffering in our world? And suffering is real, isn't it? We see it every day. You know, we see it on a global scale. We see what's happening in Turkey on the Syrian border with the Kurds. We see nationally what's happened in Manchester the last couple of days. We see it personally in our own family lives and that of our friends who go through difficulties and pain and problems. And the question is why? Why does God allow? he's so good, if he's so loving, if he is so almighty, then why does he allow suffering? And we can say, well, you know, much of suffering comes out of our own sinful and selfish nature. And it's true. That actually God gives us free will and we can treat one another how we want to treat one another. That's God's given us that option. So it's how we treat one another. And it's true. We can say, well, you know, we got an enemy that hates God and he wants to destroy God and his people and his creation. And he's called the devil, whether we believe in him or not, he's real. And he's out to destroy all of God and God's creation. And it's true. But it still doesn't take away or answer the question of, if God is so good and loving and almighty and strong and powerful and in control, why does he allow it? And sometimes it's a mystery, isn't it? And we see, as Derek just reminded us in our prayers, that Christians are not immune to this. In fact, they come under suffering in an even more tense way because we are vulnerable to all the wars and the famines and the natural disasters. But also there's persecution that comes alongside. And it's real. And you read it in those verses from 9 onwards about the persecution of God's people. So why does he allow them to suffer like that? Well, when we read the scriptures and we see from our own experience that God allows his people to go through suffering for different reasons. But we see that God uses our situations and sufferings to bring us to Christ. You know, on the Alpha Course, which has been running on Monday nights, one of the things I love about the Alpha Course is that we start with a short testimony. And I love those moments because they are real life. They are people who we know who've experienced God's love, God's grace, and I never get tired of hearing them. People say, oh, I've done it for like 8 times in a row, and I say, it doesn't matter. I love hearing them. Kim shared a testimony on last Monday, and it was beautiful. It was fantastic, and it's powerful. And we see that through the pain and through the suffering and through the brokenness and through the disappointment in life, that God, through his grace, often uses those times to draw us alongside Christ and to reveal Christ's love and compassion to us. We see, too, that God uses suffering and persecution to mature us. We see a number of scriptures. We see the gardener is the one who prunes us in John 15. In 1 Peter, we read this, that though now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief and all kinds of trials, these have come so that your faith of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may be proved genuine. And may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. So God uses those things to mature us, to cause us to grow and develop in our faith and trust in him, in our character, and in our love and in our perseverance. And we see that God uses suffering and persecution to bring about his plans and his purposes, which ultimately are for our good. We did a series looking at the life of Joseph earlier in the year, and we saw clearly there that through the ups and downs of his life, that God was working out his plans and purposes. And at the very end of the story, as Joseph's brothers who sold him into slavery were standing before him, Joseph was able to say, what you meant for evil, what you meant for bad, God meant for good, so that this family could be saved. So through that, he was at work. And we see the testimony of somebody like the Apostle Paul. It's good that I'm in chains for the gospel. Why? Because the gospel is preached to the prison guard. See, the issue isn't why, it's so much when. When is he going to call time? That was the complaint of the guys in chapter 6 when they said, how long, Lord? Why don't you do something about this? And of course, he did do something about it, didn't he? 2,000 years ago. Jesus, the man, humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross, and suffered for the sin of mankind. He gave up his life. He knows and experienced suffering and pain like no one else. And it's a matter of time before judgment comes. From verse 12 onwards, we read what's going to happen. I watched as he opened the sixth seal, and there was a great earthquake. And all these things happened. Then the kings of the earth, verse 15, the princes, the generals, the rich, the mighty, and every slave and every free man hid in caves and among the rocks of the mountains. They called to the mountains and the rocks, "Fall on us and hide from us. Hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of the wrath has come. Who can stand?" Judgment is coming. And it's not going to be pretty. Lots of people have different fears of phobias, don't they, of animals. I know I'm not too keen on sharks. After watching Jaws when I was too young with my brother's friends. Even going to Brighton was scary. And there's all kinds of names. If you're scared, they have all kinds of names attached to phobias, don't they? So if you're scared of spiders, it's arachnophobia, isn't it? And there's all these phobias. But there's not a name for the fear of lambs, is there? There is no such word for the fear of lambs, because a little lamb, a cute, cuddly, little bouncy lamb, surely isn't to be feared. But this lamb, the lamb that was slain, the lamb with seven horns and seven eyes, which represent his authority and represent his all-knowing, all-seeing, is coming to judge. And he will judge the living and the dead. He will judge all. Not one of us escapes this. And if we think we know people have got away with things over the years, then no, they haven't. In this life, maybe, but we're all going to have to give an account. And the Lamb is to be feared. He comes in judgment. And it finishes by saying, who can stand? What's going to happen to God's people, to his church during these times? And at the end, Revelation chapter 7. We're not going to read it all because I haven't got time, but I encourage you to read it at home in your private times, in your small groups. But what I do want to say from chapter 7, there are a number of things that we learn. First is this, that we learn however bad the trials and tribulations may be, God's people are clearly marked out and placed into his care. In verse 3 we read, "Do not harm the land or the sea or the trees until we put a seal on the foreheads of the servants of our God." You see, God's people, we have a mark, we have a seal put upon us. In Ephesians it talks about it's the Holy Spirit. That when we're born again, we have the Spirit of God that's given to us as a deposit, guaranteeing our inheritance. You may not be able to see it, but God sees it. He knows it. He knows who belong to him. We have a seal upon us. And even if we have to give our lives for the gospel in this life, we will not be separated from Christ eternally. Nothing, says Paul, can separate us from the love of Christ. Absolutely nothing. Second thing we realize is that because of that, God's people, his bride, the church, is indestructible. Over the years, so many people have tried to destroy God's people. They've tried to destroy the church. They've tried to destroy, and it's just grown stronger and stronger. And even in its darkest time, there will always be a remnant. Because we belong to God. Third thing we see is the number of those who will be saved is going to be large. They've got the 144,000 here. And the cults love this kind of thing. You know, they love this kind of cryptic, mystic stuff with numbers. And there's been so many weird cults. If I had time, I'd tell you about some of them, but I haven't got time, so I'm not going to. But what does it mean? What does 144,000 mean? The fact that a number is split into 12 perfectly even groups of 12,000 is meant to alert us to the fact that they're symbolic. They're symbolic. What's actually, verse 9 says this. After this I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, tribe, people and language, standing before the throne and in front of the Lamb. The number who's saved is going to be large. It's not just 144,000 in terms of literal numbers. Another thing we see is that Jesus is both the Lamb and the Shepherd of the sheep. In verse 17, we read this. For the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd. He will lead them to springs of living waters. There's a bit of a contradiction there. He's both the Lamb and he is the shepherd. He is the Lamb who was worthy, the Lamb who was slain, and yet he is also the shepherd of the sheep. And he will lead us and guide us and protect us and provide for us. And if you read through Psalm 23, it's a beautiful psalm. Then we see the seventh seal finally opened in chapter 8, verse 1. And we think it's going to be the end. Surely it's going to be the end after what we read. When he opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. Is it the calm before the storm? When they say that when a real storm hits, there's often a peace, a quietness, when all the animals are still and quiet. Has there been a delay? Has God changed his mind? No, judgment's coming. Judgment is coming. But it's not something that God's looking forward to. He's listening to the prayers that have been prayed. And he's waiting for the gospel, the good news, to go to every nation. What should our response be? That in that moment, that in that quiet moment, that we search our hearts and we're honest about where we stand before God. And we make sure that we have made our peace, that we know that we truly are washed in the blood of the Lamb, that we're covered by his blood, that we know that our sins are forgiven. And that on that day of judgment, that Jesus will be our advocate. He will be, I know this one. See, he has my mark. He has the seal upon him. And in the meantime, if that's true, then that we take the opportunity for however long we have to make sure we preach the good news to all the nations. Because this is good news for all nations, all people groups, every language, tribe, and tongue.